The Office of the State Historian is proud to present the New Mexico Digital History Project podcast series.
Please welcome Dr. David Holtby.
Thank you. A couple of housekeeping things before we begin. If at any point you can't hear me, just raise your hand. I have a fairly profound hearing problem complicated by that one of my hearing aids died on me, and so at the end we'll have a few minutes for question and answer. But if you speak loudly, Carrie, my assistant, will hear from me and help me understand what's being asked. Thank you. Second one, for those of you with electronic devices, if they're not already turned off or put on silent, if you do so, they tend to be the few things that come through and I can hear. And today's lecture is 50 minutes. We will go through a lot of material. You have an outline, and on the reverse, you have some suggestions for further reading if you're interested. It'll help you follow along. I want to especially thank my assistant, Carrie, for her invaluable help in creating the slides that you'll see today. And also I want to thank Dr. Esteban Real Galvez and Dr. Dennis Trujillo for the opportunity to receive one of their office's scholar program awards. Thank you very much. And so we'll begin. The topic is the federal government's presence in New Mexico. The period studied is 1890 to 1940. Our setting, New Mexico, was a territory until 1912. As such, the federal government controlled political life, as well as having final authority over almost everything else of substance. But after statehood, how did the government's presence impact New Mexico? To answer that question, we need to step back and see how broad currents nationally played out here. Doing so reveals that New Mexico's experience is inseparable from the nation's historical development. Two broad trends emerged in these 50 years, and they became the most important ways in which the federal government exerted its influence. The first is the emergence of a welfare state. That is, government assumed responsibility for an array of social services, passed legislation authorizing these, and paid for them through public funding. Moreover, a few of these programs had previously existed as government functions, and many had long been regarded as an individual's responsibility. I will offer various examples, but in particular, I look at two different populations, Pueblo Indians and veterans. The other major development in this period is the rise of corporate capitalism. We know that big business and trust dominated America in the late 19th century. How government reasserted itself to gain oversight and even control is the story of corporate capitalism. Its broad arc is found in how business and government went from being adversaries to becoming interdependent in the early decades of the 20th century. In the emergence of corporate capitalism, lots of give and take occurred as the government intervened where it had not previously had a direct role. Regulations were modified by business lobbying. Economic control was bent to business interests through tariffs, and after World War I, through tax policies. During the Depression years, events accelerated expansion of the welfare state and the rise of corporate capitalism, setting the nation on a path that all modernizing societies have followed. The federal government became the preferred instrument for providing the public with social services. At the same time, government assumed responsibility for fostering the economic development that paid for these benefits. So, this is the broad outline. Let me add one more generalization. New Mexico's final push for statehood from 1890 to 1912 represented an attempt to secure a new legal contract with the federal government. But this period also saw the United States begin to establish a new social contract for the entire country. So at the same time that New Mexico is seeking greater independence and local sovereignty, the federal government is moving toward a more activist, interventionist position. This new social contract became entwined in the reform movement known as progressivism. We understand that the late 19th century created an aristocracy of the wealthy and a huge underclass, mainly comprising immigrants and farmers. An industrial economy had been born, but how would government respond to this modernization? The new social contract answered this very question. It did so through government intervention to effect reform. The government's actions did not follow a concise linear path. Similarly, you will notice that while the three branches of government that are my main topics, throughout the discussion, you'll also discover that the legislature and the executive intrude, and sometimes dominate before receding. This is wholly characteristic of the federal government. It is large and not easily contained. The judiciary is where we begin, and we will look at three Supreme Court rulings and their socioeconomic consequences in New Mexico. When the Supreme Court upheld the right of the state of Louisiana to segregate blacks from whites in passenger trains, it sanctioned Jim Crow laws across the United States. Soon, barriers divided white from black throughout the South, but also in contiguous areas, including the territory of New Mexico. Plessy v. Ferguson gave legal blessing to racism prevalent in American society. How did this impact New Mexico? The NAACP formally organized in Albuquerque in January 1915, but a precursor group formed in 1912, led by ministers who had attended a convention in Denver the previous year. They opposed the imposition of Jim Crow laws in Albuquerque's trolley cars. In that era, more than two-thirds of all blacks lived in the eastern portion of the territory, so their stories are the most frequently told, especially for George McJunkin and later for Blackdom. George McJunkin became world famous for discovering the Folsom Man site and its distinctive lithic tools, but in the Clayton area he had long been a respected ranch foreman. McJunkin's competence earned him acceptance in a white world, but he failed in what he most sought, but not because of his race. He homesteaded near Folsom, and in a few years, he had acquired sufficient land and its title. He wanted to be a rancher, but it didn't work out. He could not gain access to capital, so he traded his acreage to his boss for the right to run a small herd on that land. Hold in mind this example of access to capital. We'll return to it later. Frank Boyer, the son of an army soldier who had once been posted to New Mexico, arrived in the territory in 1900. He staked claim to a homestead south of Roswell. There he established a self-sufficient community and farms for African Americans, and thus Blackton was born in 1901. 300 settlers eventually amassed nearly 15,000 acres. However, drought, lack of irrigation, and collapsing prices for livestock and crops forced the abandonment in 1920. Most of its residents relocated to Vado, just south of Las Cruces. Again, we'll return to this convergence of environmental and economic factors later in the lecture. In the autumn of 1910, 100 New Mexicans gathered to write a constitution. Albert B. Fall, a power broker in the territory, along with Charles A. Spies, the president of the Constitutional Convention, believed segregated schools were necessary to secure voter approval along the east side and in the southern part of the territory. Nuevo Mexicano legislators, a third of all the delegates, quickly recognized the inherent danger in any school segregation and beat back the proposals. As was noted in La Voz del Pueblo, and I will quote, "If this occurs in New Mexico, it seems to us very dangerous and very harmful to the future prosperity and well-being of the state. We beg to suggest to our Hispano-Americano delegates that they have to be very careful to not do anything against others that they would not want done against themselves." School segregation did not prove to be a decisive issue when voters approved the Constitution in January 1911. It passed in 22 of the territory's then 26 counties. Only Roosevelt County was in the area that Albert B. Fall felt had to be catered to. The state's total population in 1920 was 360,350. That's a 3% increase over the 1910 census. The African American population was 5,733, or 1.6% of the total population. But racial prejudice persisted in the eastern and southern portion of the state. In the early 1920s, state legislators from counties in these areas pushed a Jim Crow agenda. They enacted a law permitting local option for school segregation. Nine school districts eventually adopted separate facilities for black students. In these same communities, we know that Jim Crow practices extended to housing, restaurants, theaters, and other activities of daily life. Finally, in 1954, when the Supreme Court decreed a new social contract for blacks, these nine communities quickly integrated their classrooms. But we also know that they acted much more slowly in removing all vestiges of Jim Crow laws. The second case we'll look at is United States v. Sandoval. Questions over title to the 315,000 acres of the San Miguel Delgado Grant triggered the loss of most of the communal or ejido land in New Mexico. The case began in the Court of Private Land Claims, a specially created five-judge panel set up by Congress because of the widespread belief that deceit and not justice prevailed among territorial officials in land adjudication. The Court of Private Land Claims confirmed the grant, but the U.S. attorney in New Mexico appealed. The U.S. Supreme Court overruled the earlier decision and said that the only valid titles were to individual holdings, which totaled 5,000 acres. The remaining 310,000 acres became U.S. government property. The legal history of this ruling centers on an understanding of the 1848 Treaty of Guadalupe. But in addition to that document, I place great emphasis on situating the Supreme Court's ruling within philosophical and legal ideas held by Thomas Jefferson and John Locke, views well known to elites such as the court's judges. First, the Supreme Court acted consistent with tenets of the widely accepted Jeffersonian model of land tenure. That is, the nation's future rested on a foundation of yeoman farmers tilling their own plots of land. To accomplish that end, the government fostered homesteading after 1862 to encourage settlement in the West. New homesteading laws were passed in the 1890s and again in the early 20th century. The second intellectual underpinning for the Supreme Court's decision was derived from John Locke's ideas about private ownership. That is, only individuals holding clear evidence of title had property rights. Excuse me. These ideas supplanted Spain's tradition and in its place applied the American conception of property to land-grant heirs. To understand why the Supreme Court declared communal or ejido lands to be U.S. government property, we need to consider how the federal government viewed the public domain in the 19th century. It existed as a federal patrimony to be bestowed upon granting statehood. In looking at the map, you'll see that nine Western states entered the Union in the years preceding the Sandoval ruling. Two-thirds of these states had a larger percentage of federal land than New Mexico. The only way to secure a large public domain in New Mexico was to gain control of the communal lands portion of the land grants. The court ruled these were under the control of the Spanish crown, and therefore, after 1848, they reverted to the U.S. government. In this manner, the Supreme Court stripped communal lands from land grants and created a vast public domain in New Mexico. Early in 1913, Lieutenant Governor Ezequiel Cabeza de Vaca wrote his congressman, Harvey B. Ferguson. He complained about how federal authorities were managing the Pecos Forest Reserve. In doing so, he addressed a central concern, and one we are still trying to understand. What impact did the loss of communal lands have on Nuevo Mexicanos? The data tell us part of what happened. Between 1891 and 1904, the Court of Private Land Claims heard 51 cases. From these and other previous rulings, title to 35.5 million acres got adjudicated. 2.1 million acres were confirmed, but claims to the remaining 33.4 million acres were rejected and control passed to the U.S. government. Not all of these lands remained in government hands. In 1912, New Mexico received 5 million acres as part of the terms of statehood. Other lands were sold to private buyers, and homesteaders staked claims to public domain lands too. But the largest beneficiary became the U.S. Forest Service. In the early 1900s, the U.S. government transferred nearly 5 million acres of land in New Mexico from the public domain to the Forest Service, Carson and Santa Fe National Forests in north-central New Mexico, with a combined acreage of 2.4 million, are located on lands that came primarily from communal land grants. The loss of communal or ejido lands dramatically affected Nuevo Mexicano land grant heirs. It wrought profound social and economic reorganization. Gone was an agrarian economy based on access to this ejido. Henceforth, the Nuevo Mexicanos in the San Miguel de Ovado grant held their lands as private property. In 1904, the federal government permitted them to buy excess land in the former communal holdings that had not been kept by the government as part of the public domain. But to survive, these land grant heirs needed access to more grazing land than they could afford to buy. So, since they no longer had free use of communal holdings, they had to conform to federal dictates to graze on their former communal lands. Nuevo Mexicanos resented this new arrangement. Here's how Lieutenant Governor Cilevaca expressed the complaints of his friends and neighbors to Congressman Ferguson, shown here. I'll read. The department or officials are taking undue advantage of these people. They have their holdings inside of the reserve and are therefore at the mercy of the government officials. The condition reminds me very much of a fable I have heard. It was raining outside. An ugly toad came to the door of a small cave of a rabbit and asked to be permitted to enter to protect himself from the rain. The rabbit very kindly invited the toad as his guest. Presently, the toad began to swell and swell until the host, finding himself cruelly pushed against the wall, remonstrated, to which the toad replied, "If there is anyone who feels uncomfortable, let such get out." Cilevaca concluded his argument by saying, "These people cannot get out without abandoning the old abodes of themselves and their fathers." Lieutenant Governor Cilevaca made one final complaint in his letter to Congressman Ferguson as follows. "Now, as to the raising of the price of grazing privileges, the same condition as the above quoted exists. The people residing in the park have to pay the price or leave the vicinity. Not only did they have to pay for what had previously been free, they were now subject to rules they may not have fully understand. For example, the extensive grazing regulations prescribed such things as the exact placement of salt licks and the number of goats allowed within sheep pens. What was happening to Nuevo Mexicanos was the beginning of a process by which the U.S. government fundamentally altered the terms of a social contract. That is, the government established standards, prescribed these in regulations, and instituted inspections to monitor for compliance. And they backed it up with the coercive power of confiscation. If you did not follow these regulations, not only you lost your permit, you lost your livestock. This expansion of federal purview and power is one of several essential first steps leading to the formation of a welfare state. It established the principle that the government can and would create policies impacting everyday matter, whether people agreed or not. The breakup of the land grants was a necessary precondition for creating a large public domain in New Mexico. Its overseer became a federally mandated bureaucracy that was on the cusp of launching the conservation movement, a cornerstone of progressive era reforms. For many Nueva Mexicanos, the Forest Service became the agency most identified with the U.S. government's intrusion into their life. While the Forest Service exerted its control lawfully and carried out policies associated with an emerging conservation movement, nevertheless, the laws and regulations adversely impacted many New Mexicans. For some, resentment never faded. And in 1996 and 1997, Reyes Lopez Tijerina stirred audiences in northern New Mexico with another fable, that of the lion and the cricket. In his telling, the cricket gets in the ear of the lion, which in spite of its size and strength is rendered helpless to stop the chirping. Tijerina's takeover of Forest Service land and his subsequent courthouse raid clearly tapped into long-simmering resentment of the federal government. In 1913, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that New Mexico had to abide by terms Congress set in granting statehood. Specifically, the power and duty of the U.S. includes the duty to care for and protect all dependent Indian communities. That is, the New Mexico Constitution had to ensure that the Pueblo Indians were to be entitled to the same federal protection accorded all other Native Americans, that is, as wards of the government. In 1910, when Congress wrote the enabling bill granting statehood, they consulted with representatives from the Bureau of Reclamation, the Department of Interior, and the Department of Justice. These officials, particularly from Interior and Justice, guided legislators in addressing long-standing problems they wanted resolved. Near the top of the list was the status of Pueblo Indians. This had all become confused because the Supreme Court in 1876, in the ruling U.S. v. Joseph, said that, quote, the Pueblo Indians were not Indian tribes. They had, in fact, an anomalous status. It left them without full protection of the government. The court's decision terminated a long-standing tradition of protection accorded the Pueblo Indians during the Spanish colonial period. Their legal affairs were litigated in those years by the Office of the Protector de Indios. It is in the experience of these lawsuits that the Pueblos embraced the government as their benefactor, empowered to aid and defend them. This expectation of legal protection carried over to the American period after 1848, at least until the Joseph ruling. Strained relations soon developed between the Pueblos and the territory of New Mexico. Taxing Pueblo lands became especially contentious. This was not the first time taxation threatened the Pueblos, as those familiar with the 1837 uprising will recall. We have had meeting 2 days and 2 nights discussing against the burden taxation of the individual of Pueblo Indian. My people, they could not understand, and it is difficult for them. This was a letter from the governor of Acoma to the special attorney of the Pueblo Indians in early 1905. It expresses the consternation created by the tax issue. The territorial legislature passed a law in 1889 permitting counties to collect taxes on lands held by the Pueblos. When contested, a territorial court upheld the law. In the early 1900s, it is hard to see the intent of this tax as anything other than confiscatory. By creating a tax delinquency, Pueblo lands would be auctioned off to pay their debt. The special attorney to the Pueblo Indians warned of just such an impact in 1904. He wrote, I feel that some action should be taken while we are yet a territory and these matters are under the control of Congress. If these people should be left to the tender mercies of the native population, their condition would be pitiable indeed. The special attorney's plea for government action came to fruition when Congress wrote the Enabling Act in 1910. This bill mandated the state constitution acknowledge the federal government as the Pueblo's guardian. But 10 years after statehood, the Pueblo Indians found themselves at odds with their benefactors. The government, through the Department of the Interior and the U.S. Senate, sought to reduce their acreage by legalizing non-Indian holdings on Pueblo lands, whether these were acquired through purchase or held through customary use. The Pueblos viewed with alarm this calculated attempt to revise the map of their land holdings. Various reform groups rallied to their cause and quickly condemned the proposed legislation as a violation of the guardianship role the government was to exercise on behalf of the Pueblos. Thus, a bitter battle over Pueblo lands was joined. The eventual outcome was creation of the Pueblo Land Boards, and it established a monetary principle for having not paid attention in previous complaints. So what were these previous complaints? Well, they started as early as 1880 and were reiterated again in 1888 when the federal government took notice of encroachment on Pueblo land. Circulars were distributed in the hope that livestock would be pastured elsewhere. But the intrusions would continue for decades, and despite repeated complaints by Pueblos Indians, the federal government never took legal action to either evict unlawful occupants or prosecute illegal use of Pueblos. Suits were filed, but never pursued. Late in 1904, the U.S. Special Attorney for the Pueblo Indians initiated a petition to President Roosevelt and other federal officials. A threat to Pueblo lands prompted this unprecedented action by 18 of the Pueblos. A lasting contribution exists in his action. Bringing the Pueblo governors together to take a unified stand reinstated collective leadership that had waxed and waned since the 17th century. The petition, together with the cohesive Indian leadership forged over several years, presaged similar steps taken nearly 20 years later. In 1922, the All-Indian Pueblo Council emerged and sent petitions and representatives to Washington, D.C. to protest the Burson Pueblo Land Bill, which threatened them, their water, and their sovereignty. About the time the Pueblo Indians took collective action to protect their interests, many other Native Americans began to realize how poorly they had fared under government protection. The famous Muriel Report, issued in 1928, confirmed that a form of institutionalized poverty had settled over Indian country. The report chronicled the many ways in which, quote, an overwhelming majority of the Indians are poor, even extremely poor, and they are not adjusted to the system of the dominant white civilization, unquote. Today, we read this investigation into the economic and social conditions of reservation Indians and recognize it as describing what we now understand as a culture of dependence. That is, Native Americans had ceased to be self-reliant. Reaction to the Miriam Report and changes in government policy launched a very long journey over many decades, leading to greater self-determination for Native Americans. Now we will go and examine activities of Home Ole Burson as head of the Republican Party in New Mexico for nearly 20 years, and particularly his role as U.S. Senator from 1921 to 1925. I will talk about some other Burson bills besides the infamous land bill. That has so overshadowed and led to attacks, and justifiably so, that insufficient attention has been given to some of his other legislative accomplishments. Recalling these pieces of legislation helps us see his contribution to creating a welfare state. there is a direct line of influence from his work on veterans' issues to the ideas pursued by his successors in Congress that created the GI Bill of Rights after World War II. In August 1924, Nina Otero Warren, acting as an Indian Service Special Agent, accompanied Senator Folsom and a representative to the Pueblo of Laguna. So it was Sunday, April 24th, at Laguna. Senator Burson and Mr. Franks, Pension Bureau, there taking depositions as to Indian, I think it's cut off, veterans. Why was Senator Burson concerned about pensions for veterans at Laguna? And more fundamentally, what do such payments to veterans and their widows and orphans tell us about the origins of the welfare state? To answer these questions, we need to quickly retrace some of the history of what veterans sought as government aid after the Civil War. No soldier nor his family should be permitted to become inmates of our almshouse. A pauper's fare and a pauper's grave are not the rewards a grateful people accords to its veterans. 1868, commander of the Grand Army of the Republic. He was addressing a concern that was befalling more and more of the 2,475,000 Union soldiers, returning home in 1865. Their injuries had made it difficult, if not impossible, to resume their lives and find work. Union Civil War veterans could seek a pension only if they were discharged because of illness or disability attributed to military service. The catch, these were seldom awarded, and then only for missing arms and legs lost in combat. A large population of wounded and disabled veterans was unable to secure government assistance. So in 1866, ex-soldiers began to band together to provide private aid. One such organization was the Grand Army of the Republic, or the GAR. Soon, though, the GAR realized the magnitude of the project was way beyond their resources. So by the late 1870s, they began to talk of public assistance. That is, they called for government-funded relief for all disabled veterans, their widows, and orphans. Their call for government assistance laid a foundation for all subsequent welfare activity. It would be, 1, state-directed, 2, funded with public money, 3, would address needs that could not otherwise be handled by ordinary citizens. Specifically, the GAR and its Women's Auxiliary pushed for pensions for disabled soldiers, pensions for elderly veterans, and payments to surviving widows and orphans. But they also recognized that the Civil War produced not only physical wounds, but it affected soldiers' minds, too. Accordingly, they insisted on and secured benefits for both mental and physical disabilities. In 1862, a separate auxiliary of women emerged within the GAR. They became very powerful. By 1900, their efforts had led to significant legislation recognizing old age benefits for widows and lifetime payment to permanently unemployable orphans of veterans, without regard to whether their disability was mental or physical. In New Mexico, the first GAR organized in Santa Fe in 1883. The Women's Relief Corps began organizing here in about 1890. In 1903, the Women's Relief Corps had 115 women members in detachments in Albuquerque and Santa Fe. The men's numbers are not recorded that year, but in 1898, a total of 157 men from New Mexico gathered for meetings in 10 posts around the territory. There is a good deal of difference between $10,000 and $2,500,000. What exactly was the point made by this Democratic newspaper in Santa Fe in contrasting these sums? They were complaining about legislative priorities, and here is how they explained it to their readers. While the wool growers of the territory have been losing this vast sum, $2.5 million, Delegate Andrews has secured passage of about 50 private pension bills, amounting altogether to perhaps $10,000 a year. The The fact that he has secured these pensions has been heralded all over New Mexico by the Republican papers, but they neglect to say anything about the $2,500,000 that the wool growers have lost. Because it proved so difficult to document a pension claim, Congress provided legislative relief through private pension bills. For congressmen, such bills became a huge part of what we would today call constituent services, or aiding the people back home in dealing with the federal bureaucracy. To give you a scale of this, in 1924, Senator Holm Olbersen, as chair of the Senate's Committee on Pensions, secured passage of omnibus legislation that contained over 5,000 private pension bills for veterans or their widows from throughout the United States for combat service since the Mexican-American War of 1846. But the wool growers in New Mexico in 1908 objected to private pension bills because they believed their interests were being slighted. Specifically, they disliked changes in tariff legislation supported by President Theodore Roosevelt, which they believed had resulted in their loss of domestic sales totaling $2.5 million. Political posturing a month prior to the national elections in 1908 accounts for such comments. However, criticizing pensions while advocating higher tariffs had significance far beyond the 1908 campaign. Such political wrangling became a precursor to major political debates of the 20th century. That is, what part should government play in creating a welfare state while simultaneously fostering the rise of corporate capitalism? The Republican Party itself divided over the federal government, how the federal government addressed these competing issues. This is Holm Olbersen, and for some 20 years he was chair of the state's Republican Party. The most dramatic evidence of this intra-party rift occurred in the election of 1912, with former President Theodore Roosevelt running against the incumbent William Howard Taft, who happened to be TR's hand-picked successor. A split between progressivism and laissez-faire conservatism characterized that election and also was a rift within the state of New Mexico. What I suggest is that Senator Burson erected the proverbial large tent. He embraced both viewpoints. So let's look at some evidence supporting an interpretation of Senator Burson as an advocate for both social welfare and corporate capitalism. Upon entering the Senate in 1921, Holm Olbersen aligned himself with each side in the Republican Party's political divide. Shortly, he became chairman of the Senate Committee on Pensions, and as such, he stood at the center of a major welfare issue of his day. The 4,200,000 World War I veterans had organized into powerful political forces through groups such as the American Legion. They were pressing hard for expanded benefits, and they had a broad agenda. Pensions and related compensation figured prominently, but so too did demands for education, rehabilitation, and medical care. Between 1922 and 1924, Senator Burson worked to pass three separate bills for veterans: to repay World War servicemen for money deducted from their military pay, to provide them with a retroactive pay increase commensurate with what civilian workers received during the war, and provide pension benefits to veterans who defended the United States in its various wars during the 19th century. Over time, the purpose of these separate bills had been conflated into the term bonus bill. It gets very confusing. But all three of Burson's veterans bills passed Congress, only to be vetoed by the president. In fact, Presidents Harding and Coolidge vetoed pension bills, but a House version of the Adjusted Compensation Act did get signed into law. Fast forward a little bit. 1932, unemployed servicemen sought immediate payout of money promised in that bill, but the Hoover administration refused. The Secretary of War, Patrick Hurley, unleashed cavalry that joined with the police of D.C. to force out the so-called bonus army, resulted in mayhem and death. Patrick Hurley later moved to New Mexico and twice ran unsuccessfully against Democratic Senator Dennis Chavez. As Burson noted, the tariffs are one of the nightmares always before Congress. He well understood the stakes were very high. Tariffs were a tax levied on imported commodities. Everything that came into the United States had a tariff. They were a major source of federal revenue. However, because they limited foreign competition, tariffs often meant higher prices to consumer for things produced, higher price for consumer than those things produced domestically. When wool tariffs were under consideration in 1924, Senator Burson dutifully pushed for a high rate. The New Mexico Wool Growers Association applauded his efforts. But not everyone was so appreciative. As Burson noted, we defeated the anti-wool tariff men by a very decisive vote in the Senate, and now they are squealing, trying to make charges that we are wool growers and have no right to vote or otherwise be active in the matter of wool schedules. He went on to say, nothing in the Constitution would disenfranchise anyone who happened to be interested in a line of industry. Burson's views nicely encapsulate the mindset of these early proponents of corporate capitalism. They use the power of the government to set tariffs and thus create favorable business conditions. All this was done without regard to its impact on ordinary citizens. Now we turn to the executive branch, and we'll look at several federal agencies and the policies they administered regarding land use. How did agribusiness take hold in New Mexico? The first step involved a gradual consolidation of land holdings. This occurred essentially on the east side. In the circle are, you can't see them, but numerous sites of homesteads. There are three other areas, all much smaller and all having far fewer. The east side's land consolidation meant that greater and greater amounts of territory were held in fewer hands, and it took about a 40-year period for this to happen. But here's one story of how it occurred. It comes from Fabiola Cabeza de Vaca's We Fed Them Cactus. In 1901, after the coming of the railroad, the Rock Island Line promoted colonization into the land it traversed over the Caprock. Chartered immigrant cars brought a big colony of Iowa farmers. The people were good farmers. But the Llano country was not farming land. In 3 or 4 years, all but a handful moved to other states or went back to their homeland. Papa liked these Iowans. He bought a great many acres from them upon their departure. Drought also played a large part in concentrating land ownership, as we noted in discussing blackdom. Major droughts occurred between 1908 through 1912, again in 1917 and 18, and again from 1920 to through 1923. Perhaps the worst drought conditions on the east side occurred between 1932 and 34, when only trace amounts of rain fell in much of eastern New Mexico. John Sinclair sent his story in the Estancia Valley between 1919 and 1932. And he, too, tells of weather beating down subsistence homesteaders. Sinclair ended his book before the collapse of the bean crops. But when In Time of Harvest appeared in 1943, economic decline had come to the Estancia Valley. Let me relate one final unpublished account from the same area John Sinclair wrote about. It is the story of a homesteading family from Texas. In 1916, Willie Mae, mother of four and wife to George, loaded their possessions onto a horse-drawn wagon. The family headed to New Mexico to homestead near Torrance. With twins under the age of two in tow, they plowed their field, planted beans, then watched as the wind blew and dried out their crop. What little grew in their garden got killed by an early frost. George, unable to support his family, took a job on the railroad and soon became a section foreman near Vaughan. In 1917, drought became more extensive and brought only greater hardship. In 1918, Willie Mae realized she was pregnant. We don't know what went through her mind. Perhaps she despaired at having another child to care for in such harsh circumstances. We do know she died in an attempted self-induced abortion. The next year, George and the four children abandoned their homestead and went back to Texas. In 1960, a son returned to the homestead site. Only wind and desolation greeted him. As seen in the stories, homesteading was very hard subsistence farming. Only a very few of these farms became integrated into market-based or commercial agriculture between 1900 and 1940s. Farms failed at alarmingly high rates, conspiring against it, soil and the weather. But also undermining these people were the risks taken in borrowing money. On the eve of World War I, when the government needed to rapidly increase the food supply, President Wilson approved legislation he had previously vetoed, the Federal Farm Loan Act of 1916. This allowed farmers long-term credit. The hope was that small-scale farmers and ranchers, including homesteaders, could survive by becoming bigger and therefore commercially viable. To do so, they needed money to buy more acreage and acquire farm equipment. Such expectations sometimes came true, but in eastern New Mexico, farmers were too often crushed under the weight of three major reversals: the two long droughts between 1917 and 23, declining income from what consumers paid, declining income, even though consumers paid more for agricultural products, and finally, indebtedness they could not repay. The attempt to move subsistence farmers into the market economy failed miserably. An economist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture at Las Cruces wrote as follows about New Mexico's farm economy in 1922. With the low yields and present high cost of production, what these crops net the farmer would too often be a minus quantity. New Mexico's ranchers fared no better. They sold their cattle and sheep in 1922 for less than half what they had been paid in 1919. For many farmers, the final blow is receipt of their annual property tax bill. After World War I and into the mid-1920s, farmers, ranchers, and most especially homesteaders constantly faced the prospect of foreclosures and bankruptcies. In 1924, the attorney for the judicial district comprising Northeast New Mexico reported on his attempts to collect on delinquent taxes. "It would be a physical impossibility for my office to bring personal suits against delinquent taxpayers. It would simply mean that we would drive out of the country our farmers. I would estimate that fully one-third of our people are gone, many never to return." By 1921, the inability to repay agricultural loans began to cause bank failures in New Mexico. The first major bank to go under was the Santa Fe Bank in mid-December 1921. Here is how the Santa Fe New Mexican explains its failure. "The bank hoped to get relief from part of the load of livestock loans it carried under the Agricultural Credits Act passed by Congress, but this relief failed to come. Relief never came. And so banks continue to fold. Here are data the federal government compiled on the total number of state-chartered and Federal Reserve member banks in New Mexico, 1914 to 1941. In 1919, they reported 113 banks operating in New Mexico. 1924, 76 banks remained. 1929, 58 banks were open. 1934, 34 banks operated. 1941, 41 banks existed in New Mexico. The decline is most precipitous in the 1920s, when half of the banks closed, but in the 1930s, another two-fifths folded. In the late 1920s, the Department of Agriculture reported on settlers and dryland farming in eastern New Mexico. They concluded a very long report by saying that farming in the area, quote, "is limited to a simple, nearly self-sufficing organization. If a farmer and his family are satisfied to live mainly off the products of the farm, he can continue to farm in such an area indefinitely." The prediction unraveled under the twin assaults of the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl. In 1920, farmers in the three eastern counties of Union, Quay, and Curry had a balance due on loans totaling $15,774. Translated into $2,008, the amount owed would be equivalent of $171,000. In today's credit terms, that seems utterly inconsequential. But in 1920, it proved a crushing debt. Remember before all this homestead? Look at how few we have. Each dot's 100 homesteads. The other thing to note on the map is the circle. This is what Dr. Jose Rivera calls the acequia culture area. These were the self-sufficient. These were the farmers who remained. These were the Nuevo Mexicanos. The heartland of the acequia culture also had the lowest indebtedness of farmers. In 1920, the agricultural loans due in the three counties of Colfax, Taos, Rio Arriba, totaled $348. After the election of Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1932, the federal government sought to reorient programs and policies to combat a nearly perfect storm, a nearly perfect storm of catastrophes, an economic collapse, an environmental disaster, and a crisis of national confidence. Agribusiness benefited in two broad ways during the Depression. First, the government shut down homesteading, thus ending further alienation of the public domain. They did this through the Taylor Grazing Act. This legislation also favored grazing interest over all other uses of rangeland. The Dust Bowl afforded lawmakers the perfect opportunity to end the 70-plus year experiment of promoting homesteading on the public domain. The bill outlaws steps to stop injury to the public grazing lands by preventing overgrazing and soil deterioration. A major part of the solution involved new regulations creating federal management of range lands. Under the Taylor Grazing Act, market needs drove decisions, specifically how best to feed livestock. Over time, the environmental goals of restoring land got less attention as self-interests of cattle ranchers came to dominate the decision-making process set up under the Act. This was especially true in the early days of the Bureau of Land Management, which, following its creation in 1946, administered the Taylor Grazing Act for 30 years until the Act was superseded. The second stimulus to agribusiness in New Mexico in the Depression years came in access to credit for farmers and ranchers expanding into commercial agriculture. Six agencies offered credit or loans. Two served farmers, the Farm Credit Administration and the Emergency Crop and Feed Loan Program. Two assisted in home ownership, the Federal Housing Administration and the Homeowners Loan Corporation. And the final two agencies provided financing to public works. These were the Public Works Administration and the Resettlement Administration. In the short time we have, I'm only going to profile quickly the first and last of these to contrast support for agribusiness with assistance to Hispanic subsistence farmers. Between spring 1934 and March 1936, a subsidiary of the Farm Credit Administration, the Production Credit Association, lent 1,477 farmers in New Mexico a total of $7,861,430. Remember the figures from just 15 years earlier. These were staggering amounts in the 1930s. By the spring of 1936, they had actually collected repayments totaling $2,932,670. The money loaned went to farms deemed viable. That is, they had sufficient equipment, acreage, and know-how to survive. These recipients were identified as legitimate farmers as opposed to subsistence farmers, and this loan relief permitted them to function when otherwise they would likely have folded. Their credit sustained agricultural activity throughout New Mexico, but it also kept families intact, employed, and ensured they would continue to live on the land. A number of these farmers, especially those on the east side of New Mexico, would immediately after the war turn to intensive irrigation through drilling into the Ogallala Aquifer. This truly initiated the era of agribusiness in that section of New Mexico. The genius of FDR's programs is seen precisely in the blending of social welfare with corporate capitalism. We're all familiar with the array of social services programs begun then, with Social Security improved in 1935 at the top of the list. We also know that the federal government shored up the cultural heritage of places such as New Mexico in various programs, and in this state that greatly aided the emerging tourist industry. But in northern New Mexico, the Depression-era conditions squeezed the local farmers hard. Federal officials in the 1930s called these people, quote, a dependent, subsistent population. But government to the rescue. They provided them meaningful relief, most particularly through a type of land reform, which I argue was a form of welfare. A division within the Resettlement Administration acquired substantial acreage to allow local residents access to improved grazing lands. These grazing lands included purchases by the government of parcels from 11 land grants, with the local residents given preference in grazing rights. We have seen how FDR's administration promoted the emergence of agribusiness through the Taylor Grazing Act, as well as access to credit. During the Depression, the government also used land policy as an instrument of welfare. They gave concerted attention to the needs of the subsistence farmers in and around the large land grants taken over at the turn of the century. The Depression years bring to a close the emergence or protogenesis period in New Mexico for the creation of the welfare state and the rise of corporate capitalism. Thank you. It's 5 after. Those who need to leave, feel free. I will be able to take a few questions, and Carrie will be my ears.
Dave, there's an anecdote that goes something like this, that New Mexicans were basically a part of our economy until the 30s.
I think that New Mexico had 3 economies until the 1930s. Absolutely a barter. When you were a subsistence agriculture, you essentially grew certain things and then traded with either neighbors or sometimes with merchants in town. The second group, the merchants in town. I'm right now working on an essay. I'm basically an economic historian who does social history. So I'm looking at the emergence of the merchant economy, and it was enormous. Let me give you a figure. 1917, Albuquerque, Chamber of Commerce forms. Michael Kelleher's father was one of the leaders. Within 7 days, they had over 800 members. Not just there. So I go to Tucumcari. What am I going to find in Tucumcari? They had over 60 businessmen in their Chamber of Commerce. So there is an enormous emerging. The figure who most represents this is Governor Meacham. And he came out of and became a millionaire by having country stores and expanding. Third part are what I call the prototype agribusiness. These are the large farmers and ranchers. These are the 1,400 who accumulated $7 million in loans and could repay it. So the proportions of these groups by population, probably the barter was the largest, no doubt about it. What I'm also trying to figure out, and others have done this, and the essay by G.M. Lynn Hall is a starting point. When the lands were lost, what became of those Nuevo Mexicanos? We know from the San Miguel del Vado that many could purchase and stay, but they were basically very cash poor. So it's unclear how much acreage they got from the former common lands to add to their own. I think what happened over time, and it shows up in the Pueblo lands bill issue, was that the Nuevo Mexicanos began to move out and they began to encroach on, more profoundly than previously, Pueblo lands. Now, I don't have a great series of documents showing this, but I do have some evidence. And as Dr. Duran once reminded me one day, I should focus on case studies. There were 33 land grants left after the Court of Private Land Claims got done. I cannot generalize about all 33. I think that those that were in the northern part of the state, that's the land transfer model. It then put pressure on the Pueblo lands. That got resolved, but it got resolved confirming, most people forget this, the Pueblo Lands Board confirmed more than three-quarters of these encroachments. The minority instances were those that were rejected. And so a kind of, in Spanish, convivencia, an ability to live together, began to prevail. But I should have mentioned, yeah, the Pueblo Indians were also a barter economy, large, and they were self-sufficient, but I think that was also essentially barter. That one I could hear.
If not, it's been a pleasure to see you. I want to cut you off if there is. Otherwise, thank you very much for attending.
Thank you.